Siren Radio.
Splendid. And the weather today, highs of 19 degrees centigrade, lows of 8 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a sunny day with a gentle breeze. So you couldn't ask for better in terms of that. In fact, in so many ways, when you're actually putting these whole packages around, all you need to say are the words...
Putting together an audio show which entertains and educates the globe is a piece of cake. When you've got the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Edition teams on the case for Siren 107.3 FM and sirenonline.co.uk.
And as I'm giving that weather forecast out, as we heard earlier from Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar, identical weather forecast from that point of view, I'm thinking it's so similar to the weather last Sunday, August the 26th, at the summit of Ben Nevis, where there was once an observatory which stood there until 1904. But as is many the case, actually, the ruins still remain, and out of those ruins emerged phoenix-like, the awesome David Fox. How are you, David?
I'm fantastic, Alex. How are you doing today?
Very good indeed. Of course, it's David Fox magic, because this was something we were teasing ahead to. We teased ahead last week, if you're listening to Sound and Nick's Vision, Volume 41, the August special, where you made a wonderful surprise guest appearance there, and you said there's something that's going to be happening last Sunday in August. It was worth it. You teased ahead, of course, last week on the Midweek Drive. We couldn't reveal anything because we just thought we don't want anybody to sort of sneak into that routine. Social media's out there. You can go to hashtag Brathay Trust, hashtag David Fox Magic, hashtag Ben Nevis. I've even shared it from my own point of view. Magic at the summit of Ben Nevis. And it does look as though you're very much there in the height of summer in many ways, David. So obviously a great weather through the... was it Drich, to use a Scottish term, a Drich day?
That's a good word, yeah. That's a good word, Alex. I'm impressed.
Always like to do my research, David. You should know that.
To be fair, it was good on the way up. We managed to do a lot of magic for people walking up the mountain. And we did manage to get a bit done at the top as well. So I had the fantastic Daniel Kershaw with me, who has last year ran, he reached the 100 Marathon Club. But I did pop a link to his Just Giving page onto my Facebook page for the Brathay Trust. For anyone who wants to make a donation.
A charity which provides essential support to young people and families. Since 2007, it's been assisting with the rehabilitation of ex-armed forces personnel. And as you rightly said, you can go to justgiving.com/fundraising/Daniel Kershaw, K-E-R-S-H-A-W, and then 10 in 10, because basically that's what he's doing. He's doing a 10 marathon package in all sorts of wonderful ways. From your own perspective, and I see 10 hours ago you were standing by Bullskin House on the banks of Loch Ness. Still no sign of the monster, but never mind. It's shy from that. Did it go as expected, or is it a case of it's a David Fox magic show? It never goes as expected. Or were there any surprises that you had?
No, we did well. I mean, it was great to have Daniel with me, and everyone was fantastic. The reaction was great. So we had a very positive time. And what you've got to bear in mind is that at the top of the mountain, it does have a different climate to when you move into the cloud system at the top, because quite often it's covered by cloud. The weather can get pretty rough then and pretty windy. So we were expecting, we anticipated that, but we had a great day. We had a great time, and it was fantastic. And really, you know, we can look back now, and it was lovely to have that opportunity to do some magic at the top of the mountain. Yeah, it was great.
I've often found that this is the time of the year where if you go north of the border, the midges tend to come out in force. Were they around, or is it a case of make sure you've got lots of insect repellent?
Actually, no. We will find it tends to be down in wooded areas, humid wooded areas where you get the midges. So if you climb Ben Nevis, I've got to say to everyone out there, you won't get attacked by midges. You can have a good day out if you enjoy a walk. So don't let that put you off. Yes.
We're talking to Stephanie Romaszewski at the start of the programme. She was trekking around Dartmoor, the other end of the country, obviously, but we're talking about this as a line as well. So are you coming back to your public in Nottingham in the East Midlands? Will you be returning, David Fox? Or is it a case of, no, I'm back in the land of my fathers and I see no reason whatsoever to go down to the Sassenach land ever again?
No, I will be back. I've got two weddings, actually, this weekend that I'm looking forward to performing at. So I'll be back down today, all going well, touch wood. And lovely coming up with them.
Just looking at that image that I'm seeing now, it looks as though you have a white snit, a white kind of walking stick in your hands there. I mean, what exactly was the essence of that? What were you doing to the assembled team with that white walking stick? Were you actually sort of engaging snake charming? What was the whole essence there?
Well, that was one of the classic effects, actually using rope, and it's derived from an old classic of magic called the Indian rope trick. Which some of the listeners may have heard of.
That was
one of the reference.
You climb up and you just keep on going. It's just a whole new experience on that system. www.magician-midlands.co.uk, the best place to go to find out more details about yourself, David?
That would be the one, yeah. That's fantastic.
That's good.
You've got a good memory.
We like to ensure that full competency is provided. Still to come on the programme this morning, we've got Nicholas Lee talking about the importance of reading. And also, actually, Nicholas's line that, and I'm sure, David, you would not subscribe to this, there are a lot of people who buy books that they never actually read just to effectively have them there for show, to imply that they've read the classics or even the contemporary classics. They've never read them. That's like kind of looking at a photograph of a meal and never actually consuming something. I mean, I need to buy a book and never read it just for the image. It's not good, is it?
Very much so. Very much so. Nice. That's, I do enjoy a good book, I must say.
Exactly. Gillian Binks from Microsoft will be talking about how creativity is an essential part of our development. And as we mentioned earlier when we were speaking to Ian Lennox, we'll be talking to Amina Warner from Allergy UK and Joanna Johnson from Asda, which has suggested that nearly 70% of children actually are facing social exclusion simply as a result of their food allergy. So that's working through that. Plus, of course, from the good news front, Sarah Gale, head of Insight at OMD UK, we're talking about a new optimism which surprisingly is emerging in the United Kingdom. Well, tell that to the Scottish. No, I won't even say anything else at this particular. David, two lines, of course, that we need to, because I believe this might have been your first ever phone link, because normally you're in the studio.
It is, yeah. I'm always very lucky to come in and see you, because this is the first time on the phone.
Well, so have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this morning, magician David Fox?
I certainly have. It's fantastic. Always good to hear from you, Alex. And I hope everyone in the studio is doing well and coming and see you again soon.
Well, you see, you've already answered the second question. Is the Band of the Black Watch are actually just for you. They're marching through the mists, through the heather, down through the Dreech Woods, etc. with Scotch on the Rocks. I take it, David J. Fox, you will return?
I would love to, yes.
I don't know why I added the J there, actually. It's just David Fox, not David. Well, you David J. Fox, a whole new world there. You can also find David on at David Fox Magician for Facebook, social media, etc. David Fox, abracadabra. Take care.
Thank you very much. Have a lovely day, Alex. Take care. Thanks, sir.
One of the well-worn mise-en-scène or narrative tropes that you are taught about if you're ever doing interviews with experts, quote-unquote, is to actually make sure that you film them with a stack of books behind them, preferably with bookshelves and various other elements. It was a wonderful way, shorthand routine within televisual literacy to actually reinforce the notion of the expert and so on. But it seems it's not just people who are being interviewed on television that actually are using this whole scenario, because recent researchers suggest that a third of Britons have actually bought the latest travel guides, autobiographies, must-read novels, only to make themselves appear more intelligent, and they'll never ever read them. Now, somebody whose books are essential reading in any way, shape or form is indeed the awesome author and indeed all-round wonderful soul, Nicholas Lee. How are you, Nicholas?
I'm not too bad, thank you.
Excellent. Now, Nicholas, as somebody who is once quoted as I would define the perfect reader as someone who is willing to take the journey you've planned for them through to the end, Then this must be a complete aberration of people who are actually purchasing Nicholas Lee books and thinking, well, it's just to actually show how wonderfully well-read I am.
Well, I certainly wouldn't stop them doing that, but it would be a shame if they didn't actually then read the book, because, you know, you write these things and you take great care and you set out to make sure that the reader has a great experience as they go through them. So for them to have the book but then not actually to read it is a bit of a shame.
And certainly it does actually open up that whole question mark when you start talking about the greats, the George Orwells, the Charles Dickens, the Mark Twains and so on. So many great writers, and their books might be purchased and simply just literally just laying there in a library, unused, unread, unacknowledged.
Absolutely. I mean, I like TV as much as everyone does. And nowadays, there's so much TV, so much good TV, that it's very easy not to read a book ever. But the books have great stories in them. And if they've made their way into your home, then, you know, to sit down and actually open up the book and give that a go, I think is going to be a very rewarding experience.
It's a cliche, of course, to say that books are there to be read. You get a whole new experience from a book. It's the theatre of the imagination. It opens up a whole variety of other bits and pieces. But are people actually losing out through not engaging with that process? Because ultimately, writers, presumably, yourself included, write works to be read and to be experienced.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you want the book to be read. You want as many people to read the book as possible. And you also want as many people to enjoy it as possible. You know, these are not supposed to be difficult, boring trudges through, you know, 300 or 400 pages at the end of which you can't wait to get back to the TV. They are designed to make the most of your time and your energy while you're reading it, and hope that by the time you've got to the end of it, you want to read another one.
With technology being as it is and developing on a day-by-day basis, more and more people, myself included, tend to be doing a lot of their reading via Kindle, via other devices and things from that perspective. Presumably, we're not too far away from actually simply saying, well, if we want to actually have some bookshelves, we just need to have some virtual screens of books.
That's right. That's a very good idea. I'm delighted in the Kindle revolution and people reading on devices, whatever devices they have. I personally remain a fan of the hard copy, of something that you can hold and that you can make your way through. And by the time you get to the end of it, it's almost become your personal copy of that book that no one else really has. And then to be able to put all of those individual books next to each other, I think is, you know, I find bookshelves to be very nice looking themselves, and with a variety of different books in there, they take on their own character and their own personality. And I think they make wonderful pieces of furniture, really. And then when you go into someone else's home and you look around and you see their books and you can have a look through those, it's always very telling. But if there are virtual bookshelves, then I think that would do the same thing.
The notion of buying books with posing in mind seems, I've got to say it, Nicholas, dreadfully shallow. I mean, it really reveals a whole range of things about a person's individual notion of saying, oh, well, I've just bought this book just to make me look good.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people are impressed when they come in, then I suppose that's the job done. But when you're sitting there and you know that you've just bought that book to look good, then that's a bit of a shame for you. If you were actually to pick it up and read it and to not just start it and have a quick flick through, but to persevere and to really get into it, you might find that it was a very good purchase overall in more ways than one.
Were you surprised by any of the titles that were being put forward? I mean, the notion that contemporary aligns, I mean, 50 Shades of Grey, I would hardly have put it necessarily in the lines of a classic that you want to actually be proud of, saying, oh, well, here we are, here's my 50 Shades.
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it has become a classic of sorts now, and it might be that people want other people to know that they've read that, even if they haven't read it. So it's not necessarily about always looking intellectual. It can also be looking like you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on. But I dare say that's one of the books that a lot of people actually went through to the end.
Well, yes, no, I won't pursue that for that particular line of things. I mean, I can see that George R. R. Martin would be delighted with Game of Thrones and, yeah, and likewise Life of Pi being in there.
Yeah.
There is, of course, a line where sometimes you purchase a book and you will work your way through it, but you just sort of think, I can't do this anymore. I mean, presumably in that sort of instance, it's understandable that you may never actually finish a book. Tolstoy's War and Peace obviously used to be very popular in that particular aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had books where I haven't been able to get through to the end for one reason or another. I mean, you shouldn't have a gun to your head to get through the book. The book should make you want to go through to the end by its own merits. And, you know, it's an experimental process. You won't like everything you read, but, you know, that shouldn't stop you from reading anything.
And I would certainly recommend Blood Harmonies and Two Women from that particular perspective, from that line. Nicholas, if people wanted to find out further details about this particular survey, is there any recommended website that you suggest they should actually head to?
Not for the research itself, as far as I'm aware, but they're more than welcome to check out my books.
I think that's that would be obviously an ideal way from that point of view. Do you have a location in cyberspace people can access from your own perspective?
Just on Amazon. So Blood Harmonies on Amazon will be a good place to start.
Well, I think that makes perfect sense. And crossing over, because obviously working as a lawyer in a full-time capacity,
yeah,
never let it be said that lawyers, surely you've got to have read your books. You can't just have the books there just for show, surely.
Well, I'm sure if you went around my offices, you'd find quite a few books that haven't been opened, look very impressive on very obscure subjects, and are there if they are ever needed, but they probably haven't been needed in years and they won't ever be needed again, so...
Even in the... Who would have thought it? Nicholas, it's been fabulous sharing some thoughts with your good self. We've got two final questions for you. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, it's been very nice. Absolutely.
Well, in which case can we look forward to perhaps connecting with your good self and actually talking more detail about some of the wonderful books you've put together. I'm looking at The Confession of Dieter Berenson, I'm looking at The Condition, the whole range of things there. Will you be kind enough to return and talk about the books after we've hopefully read them?
Yes, I'd love to.
Hi, this is Liv Austin. You're listening to Siren Radio, and this is my new single, Window Shopping.
I'm not looking for a pretty face. Hot for the head's just empty space. Perfect hair, perfect teeth. Spends more time getting ready than me. Nothing more to say past the first day conversation. Might look good behind that glass, but it doesn't work like that. I gotta try you on when you had all night long. Don't care if you're fit, just if we fit. Oh, to me you got it going on. If you give me a feeling so strong, I've got no hope in stopping, and I'm not gonna find that window shopping. Shopping. I don't care if you wear Chanel. It's never been important what it says on the label. If your edge is straight, I don't mind. That just makes you one of a kind. There's nothing I want more than just good conversation. Might look good at first sight, but that doesn't mean it's right. 'Cause I gotta try you on where you at all night long. Don't care if you're fit, just if we fit up. To me you got it going on. If you give me a feeling so strong, I've got no hope in stopping, and I'm not gonna find that window shopping. No. Window shopping. Connect.
connection, feel the attraction. Won't get it from how you look, I get it from the tension. Don't have to question, just know that you got me hooked. Gotta feel the connection, feel the attraction. Won't get it from how you look, I get it from the tension. Don't have to question.
So much to look at. But I love him.
I gotta try you on. Where you at all night long? Don't care if you're fit, just if we fit up. To me, you got it going on. If you give me a feeling so strong, I've got no hope in stopping. And I'm not gonna find that window shopping. No, no, window shopping. Cause I gotta feel the connection, feel the attraction. Yeah, I gotta feel the connection, feel the attraction.
So if you're listening to our programme earlier with respect to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, you will have realised that we had a major feature with respect to technology, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, etc. But the creative industries are equally as important. And this is one of the reasons we were very keen to actually discuss a recent survey from Microsoft, which indicates that actually British parents are calling for more emphasis on creativity than academia, with 84% of parents agreeing that creativity and imagination is as important for a child's development as literacy and numeracy. Perhaps the balance is what we're looking for here. Now, to address this, we're delighted to welcome from Microsoft, or Microsoft indeed, Gillian Binks. How are you, Gillian?
I'm very well, thank you.
And also a former director from Play England, and indeed outdoor play expert and education expert, that'd be the fabulous Kath Prisk. How are you, Kath?
Good morning, I'm great.
Excellent. Gillian, if we can come to you first in terms of this, because obviously Microsoft is a company we associate completely with technology. We think, well, surely Microsoft wants more technology in academia rather than creativity at this particular area. Isn't that what Bill Gates is kind of looking for? And yet this particular survey suggests we need that balance.
I think it is all about balance. You know, technology and outdoor play should never be mutually exclusive. It's about that balance. It's about enabling people to discover more about real world activities and encouraging children's creativity and imagination.
It's really interesting in finding that parents who currently work in creative roles themselves said that their child on average does about 2.3 extracurricular activities, not sure about 0.3 there. equally as say with those people who work in non-creative roles, their children are kind of 0.9. And again, in terms of extracurricular activities, it presumably is everything from working with the guides, the scouts, just actually play and so on. I mean, we do need to play, don't we, Kath?
We do. So it's really important that kids get at least an hour of outdoor, moderate to vigorous physical activity, at least an hour of outdoor play every day. And that's one of the things we're seeing reducing over time. Yeah, our kids today are not playing out anywhere near as much as we did when we were little. One of the things I was really impressed with this research is 80% of kids are now using their tech to help their real play. Find great places to go, to look up a new skill. How do I build that den to three stories, for instance?
Well, indeed, I was fascinated to find that 31% of those surveyed used the technology to find out more about animals or insects they've actually seen. I mean, Gillian, this is a case of as we shift from our devices to becoming wearables, to becoming head-up displays, to working all sorts of other bits and pieces, we can kind of connect more. Is there a sense that connectivity is the way forward, or is it a case of we could then generate a system where people are actually simply having their head-up displays in their eyes or their eyeglasses, etc., and still actually not really engaging with the environment?
So I think that probably kind of takes us into the future of tech. But, you know, what this research is really about is how you know, technology and that real world play comes together in what we do today. And I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, 31% use it to find out about more about animals and insects. And, you know, I've got twin 9-year-olds and they absolutely are using it to find out about animals and insects. They found a little animal in the garden the other day that was newborn. So no fur or feathers or anything on it. They ran inside picked up a device to find out what that animal was. And we found out that it was a baby newborn squirrel. So it really is about that balance, about how you can bring in tech into your life, but at the same time, you know, making sure that you're spending that outdoor time.
Kath, being an outdoor play expert might be a dream job to many people because it's working through that process. Do you sense that we are getting into a world where, I mean, because I can recall people always being concerned about, oh, you're not playing outside. Or there's a lot of fear out there. I mean, parents are understandably a little bit concerned about, well, at least if they know that they're actually getting on with their work in indoors, then that's fine. And if they're outside, then they've got problems with that. Is that something we need to kind of let go of the fear and actually say, look, children will actually discover things because that's what we as human beings do?
It is. Children are designed, they're uniquely designed to be children. Children have skills that us as adults can't even begin to dream of. They suck up learning about the world through their fingertips, through their noses, through their eyes, through their ears, through their tongues. So it's really important they get outside to play every day. And if we think about, if parents are worried about the risk, think about the risk of sitting inside. Would you rather your child is sitting somewhere for 6 hours, or would you rather they're running around playing with the dirt and trees and just having a good time outside?
Finding out about the experience we call life. Gillian, we've talked about the balance and the B word in that sort of aspect. As has frequently been said by psychologists and appropriate behaviourists and so on, that we need that connection between both the theory and the practice. I was interested in finding out that parents were more likely to be proud of their child for writing an imaginative story than for solving a complex maths equation or indeed winning a sports prize. Is that something where, particularly as we're at the time of the year where the results are crazy, has gone, whether it's GCSEs, A-levels, and then obviously university starts, etc., pressure to actually work from that point of view, just actually taking time out to enjoy life, is that something where play can actually help from your perspective, Gillian?
I absolutely think it can. And one of the things which we've found is that sort of statistic is, and that view of, more parents being proud of their children for creating an art piece is actually growing over the generations as well. We've found that, 52% say that, they're quite, they're happy, they're proud of their child for writing an imaginative story.
It's a well-worn phrase I've often used, which is the more complex the mind, the greater the need for the simplicity of play. I can't claim credit for it. It's the writer Theodore Sturgeon. He used it in an episode of Star Trek, but there we are. That's another line entirely.
That is beautiful.
In terms of finding out further details, Kath and Gillian, where would you suggest people should check out? What places should they go and see?
Well, if you want to fuel your imagination for the last part of the summer holidays, which I know some parents are kind of thinking about, what can we do now? There's some fantastic creative kits from artists like Paperboyo and Will Kay on our social platforms. And there's more information on there as well.
And there are lots of activities and things to engage with, whether it's the York Maze, whether it's steampunk festivals and so on. Plus, of course, we're coming up to the season of autumn showers and various other bits and pieces. So get out there. That's the important thing. Director of Play England, former Director of Play England, and indeed outdoor play expert and education expert, Kath Prisk, and Microsoft's finest, Gillian Binks. There we are. We can have that. Microsoft's finest. Use that for all sorts of things. It's been delightful connecting to you, good selves. And we hope to speak with you again. I'm pleased we got through to you in the end. Speak very soon. Take care now.
Thank you.
I've been tired of this thinking, so I've drowned it out by drinking. Tastes like a bitter pill, but I'll just wash it down with the taste of something sweet that some doctor gave me now. And this is a madness, I'm not giving in. We're shining like diamonds, with fire in our bones. Standing beside you, I'm the feeling that I'll never.
Joys of Molly and Children of the Universe, following Children, of course, with Robert Miles. We've gone from creativity in children. Now, today, we actually have a scenario where inclusive eating, feeding all the family, is launching today in response to research that uncovers that 70% of children feel that they are treated differently as a result of their food allergy, a figure which increases to 72% when looking at school children under eight. We talked about this in the first part of the programme, of course, with our Tyneside correspondents Ian Lennox and company, and quite shocking figures, really. So to address some of the key issues relating to this, two fabulous folk. First of all, Head of Clinical Services at the charity Allergy UK. That's the wonderful Amina Warner. How are you, Amina?
Good morning. Yes, well, thanks.
Very good indeed. And also a hearty good morning to Joanna Johnson from ASDA. How are you, Joanna?
Good morning. Very well, thank you.
Wonderful. Amina, let's come to you first. I mean, this really sounds to be a substantial set of results that you've uncovered here. And we've heard about allergies and nut allergies and a whole variety of other bits and pieces, but there are a lot of children here who really kind of, through embarrassment, through shyness and so on, can be harming their health as a result of actually sort of not realising that they're allergic to things.
Yes, from Allergy UK, we do hear about this from parents and carers, etc., on a very regular basis. So really, this hasn't come as much as a surprise to us. It's good that we've actually got some information. The survey wasn't Allergy UK's survey, but looking at some of the information and the data, we talk about inclusivity in society nowadays, and to make children feel excluded because they might be slightly different because of their allergy, etc., is unacceptable. And it's good now that we're talking about it, and that hopefully things will be addressed as well, because we've heard of cases where children are having food with their friends in school, etc., but they're made to sit on a different table and made to wear even red tabards to identify them as food allergic, etc. So it does give them a bit of a complex in some cases, and parents can be very, very anxious when others are looking after their children if they've ever watched their child have an allergic reaction. It's frightening.
Certainly that notion of being made to wear different tabards is almost like food apartheid, really. I mean, Joanna, from your own perspective at ASDA, what's your own thoughts on in terms of how children can actually, you know, be more confident in actually saying, well, no, actually, I don't want to take those nuts or that orange juice because actually it's not really how my body reacts?
Yeah, we definitely want to raise awareness and make it the norm to speak about allergies and intolerances. And we're passionate about championing inclusivity and teaming up with parent bloggers to ensure we really, truly understand the challenges that parents and children face, to help them feel less anxious and to help them speak up. So the more we can talk about it, the more we hope kids and parents will talk about it more as well.
It's frequently said that as human beings we tend to be omnivorous and can eat anything. That painfully isn't the case when we look at these figures. 68% of children have gone hungry. 71% have skipped a meal completely because they don't have food which they can eat when away from home. How does this also square with the notion of, well, clearly we're also in a country where, tragically, the obesity crisis is with us and we need to be monitoring what children eat so they don't simply actually take the fun things or the supposed fun things which can cause them problems later on?
Yes, children need nutrients for them to grow healthy and develop healthy. And also, you know, you want children to be alert and you want to make sure that they're well nourished, etc., so they can achieve all that they want to achieve within life, in their educational setting, in their social settings. You know, it's good for their mental health and their well-being, etc. So, you know, for children to be feel excluded in any way doesn't have a very good impact on their long-term, health and well-being. So we want children to eat and enjoy what they're eating, and their families and their friends also to include them in. So it's great that, if free from ranges are expanded to exclude the things that people may be allergic to, so that there's a variety of choice for people and parents that are going shopping for their food allergic child. It may be that a family has two or three children with different allergens, and they've got to actually look for food that haven't got those allergens within it. So if you've got a child that's milk allergic, one that's egg allergic and one that's nut allergic, you've got to actually shop for the family, and it can take a long time for somebody, a family, to look at all the labels and try and find something to feed their child on. So it's good if that journey for them can be made any easier.
Joanna, is it a case of it's also boiling down to this labelling that, you know, there's good practice, best practice here, but, you know, people need to be aware that, you know, we've gone beyond a situation where simply saying may contain nuts is maybe not sufficient in the food labels?
Absolutely. We've got to be really clear in our signposting on everything, on all our products, because some of the, even our standard products may be suitable for kids with allergies and adults with allergies. So we've just got to signpost as clear as we can to help people, whether that's, you know, the fun things for parties or whether it's the good core staples that are healthy.
And where's the best place to go to if folk are actually listening to this and they're keen to find out further information, details, not only about food allergies in general, but in particular about inclusive eating, feeding all the family?
Absolutely. So our online guide can be found on the asdagoodliving.com website. It does help with allergy understanding and is a practical guide for parents catering for parties or picnics so all children can feel included.
Amina Warner, Head of Clinical Services at Allergy UK, and Joanna Johnson from ASDA, many thanks indeed. I'm sure you'll eat healthily. Have a splendid rest of the day. Keep on keeping on, and bye for now.
But I'm scared of living too fast, too slow. Regret, remorse, hold on. No, no, I gotta go. There's no starting over, no new beginnings. Time raises on. Just gotta keep on keeping on. Gotta keep on going, looking straight out on the road. Can't worry about what's behind you, what's coming for you further up the road. Try not to hold on to what is gone. I try to do right what is wrong. I try to keep on keeping on. Yeah, I just keep on keeping on. I hear a voice call, calling out for me. These shackles I made in an attempt to be free.
Be free, be it freeze, be it for love. try to keep on keeping on.
The future, some might say, it's not what it once appeared to be. But yet, it does seem that according to OMD UK, a new report has explored the shape of British consumer society and found that actually, despite an unpredictable financial future, British folk are in a state of contented reliance about the future. Now, to talk a bit about this and the research found in the future of Britain 5 years on, we're delighted to welcome Head of Insight at OMD UK. That would be Sarah Gale. How are you, Sarah?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Delighted to speak with your good self. I just want to clarify, no connection with the Liverpudlian duo Orchestral Movers in the Dark, because who knows what could happen. It's another OMD entirely. So that's perhaps it's OMG, it's OMD UK. Sarah, talk to us a little bit about the results and the findings of this report, because it tends to buck the trend of what many of our politicians would say, we're heading for a disaster and a nightmare of unparalleled apocalyptic proportions.
Absolutely. There were definitely some things that surprised us more than others when we did this research. So to give you a bit of context and a bit of a reminder, when we at OMD UK first set up the Future of Britain in 2013, the country was really in a position that it had never been in before. We were on this high following the Olympics and the Diamond Jubilee, but at the same time, we were also coming out of the worst recession we'd seen for over a century. People were feeling the impact of austerity, and these were evident all around them. They were seeing high levels of unemployment and the loss of lots of high street brands. But a lot of has happened since then. We've had a change in Prime Minister. We've decided to leave the EU. And we've had a slow move into economic growth, and the country's in a really different position to where it was 5 years ago. So we weren't really sure what to expect when we repeated our research from 2013. And there was a lot that didn't surprise us. We're still, as a nation, worried about money. We're still uncertain about what the future holds. And the economy, but our worries about the economy have abated somewhat compared to when we first did the study. But what surprised us most is how we feel as a nation right now. We found that people were more optimistic and less stressed than they had been 5 years ago. And also, 4 in 10 of us rate ourselves as happy. So despite the huge amount of change that's been going on around us, we generally feel more positive than we did 5 years ago. And I think that was the thing that really kind of bucks the trend and surprised us most about the research.
It's difficult to avoid mention of the B word, given that the countdown to obviously the final Brexit departure, supposedly, has been counted by financial journalists and more across the base. Why is it that then many people haven't been affected negatively by that? I mean, why is it a case of, you know, as you just said, people surprisingly seem to be, actually, it's going to be OK. Is it just false optimism?
Well, we looked at this as part of our research, and what we found is that there are a number of things that influence how we feel. So, first of all, it's important to say that there is a really strong relationship between having enough money and being happy. If we don't have enough money, generally, we're not happy. But beyond this, we also found a really strong relationship between how we feel and our outlook on life. We found that how we react to change and uncertainty is really important to how we feel. And importantly, our ability to bounce back from adversity was an important predictor of how happy we are. So overall, we think we've become more resilient as a nation. We've learned to adapt to having less money. We've learned to accept Brexit and the fact that this is going to happen. And we only have to look at our reactions to things like the royal wedding and England's performance in the World Cup to see how we can still be really great at finding the good in what happens. And I think we've gone through lots of stages when we think about Brexit. But this level of acceptance that we see coming out in social media now is also evident that people are much more accepting that this is going to happen. And indeed, our research, we found that 8 in 10 of us totally agreed that it's going to happen. We just have to accept it and make the most of it. And I think that's incredibly important to help us feel happy and optimistic. And maybe the lower levels of negativity have taken some time to get to, but are related to that acceptance of our circumstances.
I love the notion of stages of acceptance. It's a bit like bereavement counselling, isn't it, really? We've gone through the anger, we've gone through, we're now at the acceptance, we're moving through that phase. It's astounding. OMD UK, clearly it's the most more awarded agency network in the world, so fantastic stuff from that point of view. But if we're talking about online material, a lot of your advice for clients actually goes online, there are still people, and let's face it, Mark Zuckerberg was at the heart of this with respect to Facebook earlier in the news cycle, that are concerned about security. security, online security, etc. And is that still a case of people are actually a wee bit concerned about their personal data leaking to the world?
Absolutely. First of all, it's important to say that when we conducted this research, it was a time of GDPR, which is the General Data Protection Regulation, when that was coming into effect. And if you remember, we were getting all of those emails saying, can we still stay in touch with you? Can we keep your details?
It made such a change from being invited to support a Nigerian relative who's going to leave me several million pounds.
Absolutely. But that's when we did the research, and we found a staggering 87% of us were concerned about online data privacy. Similar levels of concern to that about the environment. Now, part of this might have been the timing of the research and the fact that it was top of mind to people at the time. But we wanted to explore it further. So we went to talk to people, and we found that actually the reason it was such a concern is not because we're worried about giving legitimate companies our information, but more because we're worried about being hacked or having our identities stolen. It's those big issues that concern people. We found that people generally understand that legitimate brands, there is a value exchange between them and companies, whereas if they want to access news content or video content, that they have to provide something in return, whether that's watching advertising or providing data. People get that, and they're quite happy with that. But it's incredibly important that companies safeguard data. Any companies that collect online data from people must absolutely treat it with the respect, the integrity and the value that it deserves, or people will stop providing their information. That definitely came through as part of the research.
Indeed, it's not just data protection, but it's also the fact that images can be used, all manner of things can work through on that basis. So as we look towards the next 5 years, as this report has actually won from that, I mean, I have this sense, Sarah, of you, with your name being Head of Insight at OMD UK, looking after some cyberspace crystal ball and saying, that's where we're going to go. Is it possible, or are we always going to be in the kind of notion of best guess territory based on the data from this particular analysis and so on, in terms of where we'll be in 2022, 2023?
Well, I think there are things that we definitely know. I mean, the idea behind the Future Britain and OMD UK doing it is that we put real people and how they feel at the heart of everything we do. It's about understanding kind of how people feel and how they act. A lot of that is totally unpredictable. But actually, when we look at how people feel, it's how you would expect them to feel a lot of the time. So we think that actually online will continue to grow. We think that there will be more and more content delivered online. It will be more and more tailored to people. And people will be able, even more than they do at the moment, to actually have bespoke menus of what they watch, what they read, how they get their information online. And that will be served to them by brands that they trust. Trust is incredibly important in this world. And brands that are going to get this information from people should be brands that are totally trusted. And we think that's going to grow and grow.
It's interesting that 60% of people still wish they had a technological ignore button, and I can perhaps empathise with respect to that. But when we start talking about brands that can trust people working with the things that they like, is there a danger that somehow, despite the enormity of the World Wide Web, that somehow, vis-a-vis echo chambers and so on, people actually simply like to reinforce the views and predilections that they like, and they don't take that step outside that perhaps they might have done earlier in the 20th century, for instance?
Well, I think it's always been the case that people have lived in echo chambers and accept those things that they believe more than they accept the things they don't believe. There is a danger of this, but actually I think that trusted, balanced news reporting and brands will become more and more important. I think that people are quite savvy to the fact that if they only look at certain kind of brands, and what we found in our research is that people are very, very good at now curating. They're very, very good at sifting out the things that are biased. And I think we have to give credit to people that they are able to do that. And also bear in mind that radio, TV are still massive, and they tend to present much less biased views of things. And hopefully moving forward, people will actually be able to still curate and continue to curate what they see.
Indeed, acknowledging that we all have an inbuilt bovine stuff detector, which is well worth working through. And of course, we could have done the interview via email correspondence. No, we've done it live. So fantastic stuff there. Sarah, where can people go to find out further details about the things we've talked about and indeed OMD UK?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we have a website and we have a blog where we present all of our research, because we're doing research all the time. This was a massive study where we talked to over 2,000 people. So there's a lot more stuff out there. And you can go to omdukblog.com to find out more.
Brilliant, as I say. OMG? It's OMD. Sorry, I just can't resist it. Sarah Gale, two final questions for your good self. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I've had a very interesting telephonic link. Thank you very much.
This is good. So can we prevail upon you to hopefully join us again and keep us appraised of the insightfulness that you're well known for at OMD UK? Will you be kind enough to return sometime?
I'd love that. Thank you very much.
Marvellous. So a quick roll of honour now. Thanks to Stephanie Ramoshevsky, Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Donna Dawson, David Fox, Nicholas Lee, Gillian Binks, Kath Pricks, Amina Warner, Joanna Johnson, and of course Sarah Galen, you dear listener, for being with us for however long of the last 2 hours you've actually been around. Don't forget, as far as Siren Radio is concerned, up next we've got Youssef on Thursday, and then of course we have the delightful Chris Clarkson, who's on air between 5 and 7 with Drive Time, precursor to the autumn edition of Sound and Country Vision Volume 20, effectively, with Tessa Snart and Leanie Jane in the studio, and live links with Texas-born singer-songwriter Jeremy Nail. So a whole heap of other goodies coming up on the latest edition of Sound and Country Vision at 7 o'clock this evening. Plus, of course, great news on Siren and music. Out with Carry the Crown and Body and Loud Luxury featuring Brando. Happy trails, and we look forward to seeing you in September. And I won't.